VorpalNetwork.com.
This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by Noble Knight Games, where Out of Print is available again. And listeners like you, thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store.
Hi, I'm Steve Kenson of Green Ronin Publishing. You're listening to The Tome Show.
Welcome to The Tome, Gen Con Special. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interviews show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, you're going to get to hear the R.A. Salvatore Seminar. I was originally going to give you the Dark Sun Seminar in this episode, but the official D&D podcast just released their recording of the same seminar right after I recorded my intro for it. So, no point in giving it to you now, since it's the exact same audio that they have. And I doubt very many of you are listening to me, but don't listen to the official podcast. I could also give you the Monster Builder Seminar, but, well, Bart Carroll from the official D&D podcast beat me to that one, too, since he released it yesterday. Which stings even more since he did it with my audio. His got messed up, and I was nice enough to let him use mine. Well, with that, I think I'm going to officially declare Bart Carroll of the official D&D podcast my official arch nemesis in podcasting. Nah, I'm just kidding. Bart was a really cool guy to meet at Gen Con, and I gave him the monster building seminar audio willingly. I think I recorded more audio than he did anyway, plus I have a handful of exclusive things from the con as well. Solidarity to my new arch nemesis, Bart Carroll. I still have other audio, like the adventure building seminar, which I found to be really good, and Ed Greenwood's Spin a Yarn, as well as some interviews that I can release, but I know those are exclusive. So let me know what you want to hear next, and I'll be happy to oblige. Although, again, my instinct is that the adventure building seminar was really good. Probably one of the best ones I went to, so I might try to lean towards that one for next. I'm also going to be looking for comments and questions about the upcoming Dark Sun 4th edition setting. So make sure you're calling in with your questions or thoughts or comments about those books at 919-BIZ-TOME. And I'd also love to include some more Gen Con stories in these Gen Con August episodes. So once again, give me a call at the Tome's Biz line at 919-BIZ-TOME. That's 919-BIZ-TOME. Now it's time to hear from our sponsor and then off to talk to R.A. Salvatore. But right now, it's time to talk Noble Knight Games, and my pick of the episode is Dark Sun Revised and Expanded Box Set from way back in the 2nd Edition days. This is the box set that introduced me to Dark Sun. It still sits on my shelf today. If you want to get all the details about Athas that they couldn't quite squeeze into the 4th Edition Dark Sun books, then this is one of the few places where you can get it. It's long out of print, and it's in pretty good condition here, so it does run $60 from Noble Knight Games. But it is made out of awesome and comes with a cloth map. You don't see cloth maps these days. Check it out.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
2010 Gen Con's R.A. Salvatore panel. It's good to see you all here. I recognize a lot of faces, so it's good that you're back for more. Anyway, with no further ado, New York Times bestselling author of The Legend of Drizzt, R.A. Salvatore.
Thank you. I made her do like to put her on the spot. She's my new editor, Susan Morris. I'm going to drive her into the church. Is this thing even working?
What church is that?
My second editor was. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
My second editor was Eric Severson for many years, He was a copy editor on my first book, then became my editor, and then he left to become a Unitarian minister.
Oh.
I broke him.
So you're good for the ministry.
You'll see Susan in a couple of years, and she'll be all gray, walking around like this. I promise. Okay. I want to talk about a lot of things today, but we have a lot of time, which is cool. Right? Usually it's an hour, we get two, so we get lots of questions. So if you don't ask questions, we're going to play the trailer 50 times, and you can deal with it. Wizards of the Coast was gracious enough to allow me to bring the trailer for the game I'm working on over at 38 Studios. We're working on two games, and I'll start just letting you know what's going on in my world with that. About 4 years ago, almost exactly to the day, 4 years ago, I got a call from Curt Schilling, the Boston pitcher. And I'm a huge Red Sox fan. I live in Massachusetts, so that was kind of cool. And I pick up the phone, and he says, can I talk to Bob Salvatore? I'm speaking, and he says, oh, I can't believe I'm talking to you. My favorite author, this is Curt Schilling. And I'm like, screw you. And my wife is over there laughing because apparently his publicist had called earlier to confirm that that was my number. And she's like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm talking to you. He says, oh my God, I can't believe I'm talking to you. So for 20 minutes, we just went back and forth. And he told me that, you know, he's getting near the end of his career at that time. This was 2006. He only had a couple of years left, and he knew it. And he wanted to start a video game company because he's the biggest nerd on the planet, and he is. And so he asked me to come in and create the world for his video game company, the IP for his video game company, which was called Green Monster Games, but is now 38 Studios. I don't have a wizard shirt. That's why I'm wearing that. They're going to get me one, though.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. I like free stuff. So for 4 years, we've been building an MMO. And it's going to be huge. And it's going to be beautiful. And it's going to be, I think, cutting edge. We've got an amazing team. But what happened was, last year we got the opportunity to buy a company called Big Huge Games. They did Rise of Nations, some other Catan. And they were in development of an RPG engine that's really amazing and a game that they were trying to put together. And they had just signed up Ken Ralston and Mark Nelson, who were the guys who did Morrowind and Oblivion, the lead designers. So when we got the opportunity to buy BHG, we said, hell yeah. And we bought BHG. And we introduced them to our IP that was now 3 years in the making. And they loved it. And we told Ken and Mark, find a place, find a time in the world, and write us a story for this open world RPG that we're doing. And they did. And the result, you're going to see in a minute here, is a game that's coming out next fall, a single player RPG. It'll be on PS3, Xbox, and PC. And it's called The Reckoning. And if Susan can get the lights for us here, we're going to play the trailer. It just came, debuted at Comic-Con, directed by Todd McFarlane, our art director.
You're in the way?
It's one of
them. Okay. Yeah, what Kurt did is he called me and Todd. Me to design the world, and Todd to do it. Because Kurt's been friends with Todd for a lot of years, because Todd did the Major League things. Stop.
Going back in time now.
Shut it down. Don't let them see this. Lights back on while he works on this. So you're not going to get to see the trailer, but we have three boxes of free T-shirts for you folks. So you can. I bribe people to come.
We're not seeing it on the website, so
he'll get it.
I better get it fixed. My job. You know.
I won't tell them, Gary, but these people will. All right. All right. So anyway, that's the 38 Studios product that I'm working on. Also, I went back to Corona, my Demon Wars world, a few years ago, to do the. I wrote a book called The Highwayman, which I really love. And then I signed a 3-book deal with Tor Books to finish that series. And so the fourth and final book in that series, The Bear, will be out August 18th. And if you haven't read The Highwayman, what I did when I wrote Demon Wars is I did this huge 7-book series, and I hope you'll read it. I think it's some of my best work. I really do. I'm very proud of that. But then after I got done creating the world and the gemstone magic and the social structures with the 7-book series, I went back and wrote Dritz-like books, if you will. kind of personal stories, and that's the Highwayman saga. Saga of the First King, it's called. There's four books, The Highwayman, The Ancient, The Dame, and now The Bear, which is coming out August 18th. And that'll be the end of that. I will be going back to that world again. New characters, new time. It's my Forgotten Realms, if you will. The third thing, in November of this year, will be the third book in the Stone of Tomorrow series that I wrote with my son. And that was a blast. And the Stone of Tomorrow books take place, the first one takes place, it coincides with the Halfling's Gem. So I got to write some of my favorite scenes from the Halfling's Gem from a different point of view. Well, think dwarves, flaming chariots, things like that. Okay? And I got to write them from the view of people going, what the hell is it? It's very cool. It was very cool. And Gino and I had a blast doing that. And I can announce, I believe, because it was announced to San Diego, right? Okay, Gino and I are teaming up again to do a new story arc of Dritzt comics with IDW. That'll be out in 2011. And I think 2011, we haven't seen our deadlines yet, but we've already started them. And those books, those comic books will take place post-Ghost King. So, they're new. We're not just taking the Ghost King and turning it into comics. We've got new Dritzt stories for the first time outside of the novels. There'll be new Dritzt stories. And that'll be next year. So, and then the big news of all of them for me is a few months ago, Wizards and I came to a new agreement for six more books. So counting the book coming out this October, Gontalgrim, which will be out early October, picks up after the Ghost King, there'll be at least seven more Dark Elf books. And I'm very happy about it. It's funny because I always hear about authors who kind of get trapped by their success, you know? And they feel like, well, I want to do something else. And I have wanted to do something else. But because of Dritzt, I've been able to go do Crimson Shadow. And I've been able to do Demon Wars, which I still, you know, I will still do Demon Wars. And I was able to do Spearwielder's Tales and all the rest of it because of the success of Dritzt. But I've never felt trapped by Dritzt. And I've always said from the beginning, and I mean it, when I'm not having fun writing him anymore, I'm not going to write him anymore. But still I'm fun. So I'm going to keep writing. Until I'm not having fun. Or until he meets an untimely death in one of the books. Right, Susan? So I think, you know, for me, it has been an amazing journey. And every time I come back to Gen Con, I'm reminded of it. Because you see so many old friends. And it's hard to believe I've been doing this for 22 years. And it's just been the most amazing journey. More fun than I deserve. I think back to when I sent my first book in. How many people in here are writers? Okay. Don't be afraid to ask just generic writing questions when you go to Q&A. We got a lot of time today. Had I sent my first manuscript in 3 months earlier or 3 months later, it's very likely I would never have been a published author. That's what this business is like. Let me explain. When I sent my manuscript for a book called Echoes of the Fourth Magic, which was subsequently published by Penguin and then again by Del Rey over the years, to TSR in January of 1987, they had decided they were going to do a Forgotten Realms book line. They had the first book from Doug Niles ready, and Doug was writing the second book, but it was going to be a year. And they decided they needed more books. So if I had sent my manuscript in 3 months earlier, they weren't looking for Forgotten Realms novels. Now, they didn't buy that manuscript, but they asked me, would I be willing to do an audition for a Forgotten Realms novel from that manuscript. So 3 months earlier, they weren't looking for Forgotten Realms novels, and they had no room on their schedule for independent novels. I would have gotten a nice rejection letter. Hopefully a nice one. Some of them aren't. 3 months later, this was in January, in like March, April of that year, the sales numbers came in for Doug's book into the stores. And all the people at TSR realized this was going to be big. Because you have to understand, all the writers that were working there at the time, really good authors, I'm talking people like Jeff Grubb and Troy Denning, and Doug, of course, and Mary Kirchhoff, they had a ton of talented writers that they knew worked for the company and people they could count on to get a book in and done on time in a good book. But none of them were scrambling for Realms novels because they were all writing Dragonlance novels. Dragonlance was New York Times bestseller, right? That's where you're going to go. You're not, if you're writing that, you're not going to jump over to a different world. So 3 months earlier, they weren't looking for anyone. 3 months later, I would have been competing against people I couldn't have competed against from the outside at that time. And that was it for me. If I didn't sell it on that round after 4 years, I was done. So that's what the business is like. I just put it right in the middle and got in the right place at the right time. 22 years later, after having been retired for 20 years writing books, here I am. So for you guys who are writers, don't take it personally. And understand that for every person writing, there are 100 more who, for circumstances other than the writing, may never get published. That's just the nature of the business. How are we doing on this?
Just trying to figure out why the sound isn't coming
out. Okay, let me know when you get it, okay?
And of course, all right. The going.
So we're going to wait for the trailer. They'll have it. They have plenty of time to figure it out. If you hear a zap and somebody falls over, yell. I'm responsible for him. He works for the... And that's my wife. I don't want Greg in. Fine. Okay, so I'll open it up for questions while we're waiting on that. Who here has a question?
I asked you yesterday about one that I actually got a little close to you. Crimson Shadow and your Demon War Saga, those worlds, are they linked at all? Because I noticed a few, like the name of the sword kind of crosses over a little bit, stuff like that.
Crimson Shadow was going to be Demon Wars, but I didn't have the time to flesh out the whole world at the time. And I'm very much thinking if I go back to Demon Wars the next time, I'll bring Luthien and Oliver over to the Demon Wars world and link the two. There's legal questions about who has the option on the next book, because we're three different publishers here. That's Hachette. That's doing Crimson Shadow. But I love Crimson Shadow and Oliver DeBarros. Who knows Oliver DeBarros? I think he's my favorite comedy character ever. The only thing I can tell you about Oliver is Oliver is a cross between Inigo Montoya from The Princess Bride and the little French guy on the wall in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And he's a highway halfway. You know, highway man? Well, he's a highway halfway. And Oliver is really cool. And the fun thing about writing Oliver is he doesn't just tell a joke. That's not how you write Oliver. When Oliver says something, you read it, and you go on, and about 3 pages later, you should groan and look back to see if he really said that. If you do that, I wrote Oliver correctly. And Oliver was the only character who actually started in a game. And because when I had the idea for Oliver, I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to pull it off or not. So I played him in a game. And my little level one halfling rogue, who was also a little bit Sir Robin, if you watched Holy Grail, not the bravest guy around. So I remember the adventure. We're playing this campaign, and the guy who was running it at the time was one of these incredibly detail-oriented people. So we would go over for a Sunday night for the game, and we'd sit down to a meal with the Duke. And the entire night would be him describing the meal to us. So we're 12 weeks or so into the campaign, and we're still first level. We finally get on the road to adventure. And we're coming up on this Parthenon-like ruins with the columns in front, kind of this flat bed of ruins behind it. And we're, you know, humping down the road. And the wizard has a scroll that he acquired in the town for clairvoyance. So he uses his scroll, and he looks the idiot from the pillar's back and sees that it's clear. And he says, oh, the coast is clear. So, of course, as soon as he says that, I'll lead. And Oliver goes dancing up the steps. And against one of those posts was this gigantic ogre with this gigantic maul. Now, in our game, we have our own house rules on criticals. If you roll a natural 20, you roll percentage dice. 0 to 85, you get double damage. 85 to 99, you get triple damage. 100's instant kill. So the ogre jumps out, boom, on my little halfling first level thief. 20, of course. 95 or something, triple damage. So consider this. I'm a first level thief. I have 6 hit points. The ogre's +6 to damage. and rolled triple damage. And then he rolled a 10 just to add insult to injury. So I took 48 points of damage. For those of you who don't game, what that means is that Oliver was splattered all over the stairs. And I knew at that moment that Oliver had worked, and he was going in the books, because everybody at the table stood up and cheered. Is it a go?
It's a go.
I heard the name. All right. I think we have a trailer for you.
It may only be in mono.
It may be mono.
Is that a disease?
It's McFarlane. You may get diseased. Yep.
But we don't have to
cover your mouth.
Oh, I think they're going to blow you right out of the back of the room.
Let's hope not.
Can you hear it?
Yeah, but we can't see it.
Yeah, but we have no video. Video, no audio.
You love our game, really.
It's like, we'll play the audio, then we'll play the video backwards.
What'd you do?
I'm working on it, boss.
You made the sacrifice for the audio.
Yeah, I think the projector went to sleep.
The projector's waking
up.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So we'll blame them. It's them. It's your computer. It's not our game.
The game's technology is much better than
you. Okay, here we go.
All right. Take five.
Listen carefully. The words mean something.
Maybe too loud.
Move your mouse.
It is said that there is but one thing certain in this world. All that lives must die. This is the bargain into which all must enter. One birth, one death.
One complaint about that. The game is prettier. When you see this game, you're going to be blown away. I promise you. Okay, question. The game is coming out next fall, and so we'll be giving little things all the way through. There's very little information out about it, but...
When are you going to write a novel based on this world?
That's iffy. We don't know yet what our plan is going to be for that. It's possible. I'm more connected with the MMO than the RPG, though. But
is it the same world?
Same world. What happened was when I came in to do the project, what I thought first is, if you're going to have an IP that you're going to have artists and designers and writers and even mechanics designers coming in and working on, the important thing is to have a canvas so everybody's painting on the same canvas. So what we did was create a 10,000-year history of the world. And all the races make sense. And I can tell you this about the world. One of the things that's just happened in the world, and this is the Reckoning includes this, but the MMO more so is, and this is the way we're approaching this IP. It's not enough to just have things and say, well, it's magic. Because I believe whether you're writing a book or making a game, the less you ask the reader player to suspend disbelief, the more that makes sense to the reader or the player, the more immersed they will become in the world. Okay? So the way you do that is that not just that things have a reason, but things have a consequence. So, for example, in our game, what has happened in the world is the Well of Souls. It's been perfected. They've been working on it for centuries. millennia. They finally found a way to make it work. In the Well of Souls, if you play an MMO, what's the thing you take for granted? Resurrection. Right? An MMO without resurrection, nobody's going to play for long. Unless it's as easy as WoW, and then you don't die anyway. And I've been playing WoW for 5 years, but if you go and raid Icecrown, then you go out and play in the world, it's like you summon everything in the zone, and they all fall dead while you're talking on the phone. Anyway, it's not, so you don't just spawn in the graveyard. We have the Well of Souls, and there's a reason for it, and there's a story element for it, and it has a consequence. But it's not enough to just say, this is why someone. And this is what I keep telling the writers and the designers over and over again. What does it mean to the world to suddenly have resurrection? What does it mean to the priest whose entire power base is because he's promising people an afterlife, if suddenly you don't need the afterlife anymore? What does it mean to the political structures of the world? What does it mean, you know, I mean, imagine tomorrow if they came out with a pill and said, you take this pill, you're immortal. And they would go, wow, that's cool, that's great, awesome, give me one. Would they, after they thought about it? What does it mean to the mother who lost her son or her daughter and was saying to herself, for all the years, when I die, I'll be with them again? That's what I'm making the writers think about when we're working on quests, when we're working on content for this world. Suspension of disbelief should be minimal. We want it to feel like a real world. And the other thing we're really working on is we want parts of this world to be beautiful, gorgeous, warm, home. Something worth defending. And then other parts of the world to be worth fighting. And these are the philosophies that we've taken through this company. And they're hammered home every single day. I think it's going to work. I'm really excited about the new builds on the MMO. So, for what it's worth, Fall 2011, Reckoning, MMO to follow. Not announced yet. Yes.
You mentioned the 10,000 years.
Reckoning is in the past.
Okay.
It's a couple thousand years in the past. But there are things that happen in Reckoning that will make more sense when you play the MMO. And things that happen in the MMO that will mean more if you've played. You can play either. We're not making them dependent on each other. But just if you do play both, you should have a richer experience and understand how they connect. Yeah.
Will the MMO reference it?
Huh?
Will the MMO reference?
Can't get into that yet, but it's very possible you will see things. Yes.
One quick question. Races.
Races.
I mean, so far, multiple races.
Yes. Yes. Lots. New twists on old races. Some standard expected archetypal character in races. Yeah, absolutely. Multiple races. More in the MMO than in the RPG, obviously. Just because of the way the systems work. Yeah.
As far for the MMO, what ones are you looking towards existing MMOs to get your ideas on how you would set up the game mechanics? And would you say it'll be like WoW?
We have, you know, I don't know how to design a game. Todd McFarlane doesn't know how to design a game. Kurt Schilling doesn't know how to design a game. So we have stolen. We have stolen the lead designer who came in and fixed EverQuest 2 and another legendary designer from Sony. Our UI whiz was the lead UI person for World of Warcraft. Our server guru was the server guru for Blizzard. Our CTO was the CTO for EA. We have stolen a level of talent that you would not believe. And we're looking for all the things that work in the situation that we're presenting in our game. And you have, you know, you have, this is what an MMO is. You can't say, well, this is what an MMO is now. This is what an MMO is, and we're going to go a little bit here. But confidence is high.
On your MMO, I'm assuming you're going to start out at like a, I don't know, like a city or, you know, I mean, when you first...
Yeah, do you start somewhere? I'll tell you that.
Well,
much.
I mean, are your race is going to be? I mean, is it going to be a separate city for each race, or are you all going to start it? You know what I'm saying?
You know, you always have what you want, and then you have what winds up at the end, and a lot of times that means 2 more years of development, and $30 million more dollars, and you can have this. But we want each race to be a distinctive, where the starting zones will tell you about what the race is and who they are and why they are. We've got the history. We want to show it. We've got book questions. I can do both, but who's got book questions?
Gauntlebrim.
Yes.
Is it going to be post-Spellplague or still in the...
I'm already post-Spellplague. Okay. Ghost King was post-Spellplague. Yeah, the transitions meant what it said.
But I'm...
And the transition is transition from pre-Spellplague to the current realms.
Right, but he's going to be...
Pretty close. We're getting there in a hurry. We're getting there in a hurry. Yeah.
So, really quickly, with the MMO, you say you've written 10,000 years of history.
Yes.
I assume this is going somewhere either at the beginning or the middle of that.
No, it's a couple thousand years from the present day where the MMO will be.
I'm just wondering, the big complaint I have with most MMOs is that they kind of separate where the game goes and the new areas open up from what the players are actually doing in the game. Or how
we believe in consequence.
So you're going to have actual consequences for what characters do in the game?
I don't know how much I can talk about this, but I will tell you that if all the servers look the same 6 months into the game, we fail. I'm going to leave it right at that.
Can you give us a general idea of the size compared to, say, Azeroth?
We're shooting for the size of the general MMOs. You know, there is a lot of research about how long it should take to cross a zone and when people are just saying, okay, I've had enough, and how fast you should be able to get from place to place. And there's a lot of tug of war on that, too. I mean, everything in a game, when you're designing a game, is a tug of war. When I'm writing a book, I write the book. And then I have a little fight with an editor, but we're okay. When you're doing a game and you've got people with different ideas, like, you know, if I was designing the game that I want, it would not be a commercial success in a post-WoW world. Because a game I want, you'd go corpse running. A game I want, you'd run across zones, and it wouldn't be easy. A game I want would involve encounters that were based on chaos, not mechanics. And what I mean by that is, you didn't kill them fast enough, here come a whole bunch of wandering monsters. But you can still win. But you can't win by following a prescription that you read on Thoughtbot or Alakazam or something. You will win by improvisation. One thing I loved about EverQuest was improvisation. I played a wizard. Slowed the group. Got aggro on a couple. They're chasing me. Route one. Running out, root the other one. Meanwhile, my group is killing the rest, because if they were all in there, the fighter would be toast, or the priest would heal him too much and he'd be toast, right? That's my game. Now, that doesn't mean that's going to be Copernicus, our MMO. Because when it comes to mechanics, I'm one voice in a company of over 100 people now. And I'm not the deciding voice by a mile. So please don't go and say, Salvatore says we're going to have death penalties and we're going to have corpse runs. No. I posted a big disclaimer, okay? And I don't want to see that. Because if not, I don't know what the end result's going to be. It's not my decision. I can guarantee you that the game I want would be a complete failure commercially. But I would love it. Because I'm a hard ass. I do not like... The only way I die in WoW is if I'm too high up when I jump off my mount. I don't play much anymore.
That's not really true. I jumped 100 foot and didn't die, so...
Yeah, well, and to me, with Burning Crusade, what happened is all the dungeons became mechanics tests. Stand here, away from the spores, do this, 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 and this, and it's cake. until you do this, 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 and this, you can't win. Right? I have a completely different style of game plan. Mostly because I suck. And when I'm in a raid, and everybody in the raid knows what I'm supposed to do, and if I don't do it right, they all get mad at me, I feel bad.
What's it like writing the backstory and seeing it kind of big shape?
It's amazing. It's like watching Todd Lockwood do a cover for a Dritz book. It's the same feeling. When I go in there, and we hired also Aubrey Hodges, who did the Halo music, won awards for it, and he got Gene Rosenberg in, who's got a distinctive Eastern Europe flavor to his instruments that he prefers, so we could get this incredible scope. And then we brought Duncan Watt in, who's incredible with the orchestras. So our audio team is unbelievable up at 38. And when I go in the office, they don't say, come here, here's the music for this zone or this race. They say, we want you to listen to something. We go in there, we sit down. Gary will back me up on this. Aubrey gets the music going. After 5 seconds, I go, that's her, and I name the race. And they high-five, because they nailed it again. And they go right through. These people are so bought into the game on every level. That's why it works. Okay, in the back here.
You said you wrote the backstory. Are you doing any, dramatic cutscene dialogue or anything like that?
In telling a story in a computer game, you have X number of ways to do it. Right? Nobody wants to read through 5 pages of text. Right? You click to the end of the quest. What do I got to kill? Come on. I know you do. I know you do. VoiceOver is another tool, but VoiceOver can be hit or miss. You know? So you have that tool. You have those two tools. You also have cinematics, which we hope to employ. You also have something that Wrath of the Lich King did very well, which is zones changing because of your actions. And I remember my wife and I were playing in one of the zones, and we were standing next to each other and couldn't understand why we couldn't see each other. It's because I hadn't completed the quests yet. We were next to each other, but we weren't. And that's a storytelling tool. So you've got a lot of different storytelling tools that you can use, and then you just have to find out which one works in which situation. You don't want to rely too much on anyone. You know, I don't want quests that go on for 1,000 words. That's 900 words too many, okay? Because nobody wants to sit there and read quests. So we've got a whole bunch of tools in the toolbox, and we're developing new tools in the toolbox to tell the stories. And we know we're only going to tell 1/1,000,000th of the stories we could tell about this world, which leads to other products, we hope.
Back to your books.
Thank you. Wizards paid for me to be here. Talk about this.
Now that Spell Plague has happened, and obviously Artemis has passed on for 100 years.
Has he?
Yeah, I don't know.
What that? Wow, is he going to be pissed when I die?
What's the consequence of him coming back?
I'll pop back up in the new book. In the new books that are coming out.
Oh, I don't know.
He is a dark
one.
I can pretty much guarantee you that I consider 70% of my job being smarter than the game designers. So I can get away with things. Or maybe not smarter than them, just hiding really well. I wouldn't count some of my favorite characters out just quite yet. But I don't know yet. Or maybe I do, but I'm not telling. So
when it comes to writing in other people's worlds, like when they introduced the spell play,
yeah. How
did that affect you as the writer, knowing that this is the world I was in, now they're changing the rules?
They had bomb threats at their building for 15 days. I'm totally kidding. A few years ago when I came out to Gen Con was when they were talking about the 100-year leap. And I had the Bible on the plane, I was reading the Bible. And there's some things I thought were really cool, and there are other things I thought I didn't like, and there were some things I thought that were really cool, but I wouldn't do it this way, I'd do it this way instead to get to the same place. And then I came out, and me and Ed Greenwood and Thomas Reed and Stephen Shen and I think Rich Baker and Bill Slavicek were in the room, and we were going through this, and they let me have my say. And then I wrote this big, long letter, explaining my positions, and I sent it to Wizards of the Coast, and they let me have my say. And then they did what they wanted to do. Because, no, I'm not saying that in a bad way. This is their job. This is what they are doing for reasons that have to do with the game, for reasons that have to do with what they've decided is the direction they want to go. They let me have my say. I think a couple of things I said, they thought, he's right. A couple of other things I said, they said, we don't agree. And they went and they built the new sandbox. Okay? Now, I'm a writer. I'm a professional writer. I have lots of options. I can call Del Rey, Hachette, Tor, Ace tomorrow and sign a book contract. Or I can just go work with 38 Studios full time. I have a lot of options. They show me their new sandbox. It's their world. If I decide that I want to play in their world, it is incumbent upon me as a professional writer to adhere to their sandbox. So I look at their sandbox, and I look at what my characters, the ones that will come through, Dritz, okay, will be in their sandbox and what I can do with him in the new sandbox. And if I'm not excited about that, I don't sign a new contract. I just signed a new contract. That should tell you how I feel. Okay? Would I have done everything the same way? No. I don't think any two creative people do the same thing the same way. Are there a lot of good things that are going to come out of this in terms of being able to bring new people into the realms and revitalize the realms and update the realms? I think so. And I'm having a blast. I'm there because I want to be. So is Ed Greenwood. So, you know, take that as a stamp of approval from us. There's not going to be any chinks in the armor here. It's their sandbox, and I am privileged and thrilled to be 22 years and counting in that sandbox. Okay? Wait a minute.
Is there any more talk about bringing Grits to the big screen?
Come on.
You know?
We won't tell.
This is weird.
Anyone who's ever worked with Hollywood will tell you that when you go to the theater and see it playing, believe they made a movie. Okay? I don't own the realms, obviously. It's a licensed property from a merchandising company, which complicates a lot of things. This company also happens to have Transformers and G.I. Joe, which are, you know, printing money at the movies right now. I can tell you that I have agent for my other properties. And I have an A-list producer, an A-list star, and an A-list writer attached to one of my properties. That it looks good that we're going to get an option real soon on it. I can also tell you, this is the whole is Dritz a blessing and a curse question, right? Every major studio person, actor, writer we've talked to who has been interested, and then the next question out of his or her mouth has been, can we do Dark Elf? I've been thinking it's going to happen. I used to be, like, really hardcore on this, right? I used to be, you got to make a Dritz movie. Come on, make a Dritz movie. I want a Dritz movie because I wanted that moment. When I went to see a movie with my friends, and I never told them anything, and we went in the theater and we sat down, and the trailer came up for Dritz, or any one of my books for that matter, and I would just stand up and go, ha. That's a moment I want in my life, okay? But it's been tempered, and I blame Guy Gabriel Kay. Y'all know Guy Gabriel Kay? If you own the Vibe Tapestry, helped Christopher Tolkien write The Silmarillion, okay? He's a brilliant writer, brilliant guy, Oxford guy. I mean, really. He's a cool Canadian, is what he is. I met Guy at a convention at Harvard University a few years ago, right when the Peter Jackson movies had just come out. And he asked me, he said, what did you think of the Peter Jackson takes? Because he's friends with the Tolkien family, he worked with the Tolkien family. You know, Christopher picked him to help him do the Silmarillion. What did you think of, Peter Jackson's adaptations? I said, well, I loved Fellowship of the Ring. liked Two Towers, liked Return of the King, but I really loved Fellowship of the Ring. I think he did an amazing job all the way through. Thumbs up for me on those. He said, okay, but, and this is when I got hit in the gut. How do you feel about the fact that from this day forward, no one will ever again come to Tolkien's work through the books? Wham. Wham, right? Is anyone ever again going to read Tolkien's books and not see Liv Tyler when they think of when they see Arwen? And when they see Glorfindel come across the stream to rescue Frodo, they're going to be, who's this? Where's Arwen? Tom Bombadil? What's that? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, I can live with it if it doesn't happen after. Thank you, guy. It seems to me so obvious that this is the time. I mean, you've got comic book action movies grossing hundreds of millions of dollars. Now you've got something that's even less suspension of disbelief than the comic book that can have the same kind of movie. You know? So I think it's going to happen. But I don't have anything in stone. And I didn't get a check, so.
I was just wondering what the hardest part as a writer is about leaving some of your creations behind because some of this junk.
Oh, it sucks. But you know, when I wrote Demon Wars, I love it when people come up to me and they say, oh, nobody ever dies in your books.
Yeah.
I say, have you read Demon Wars? No. Then shut up. What do you want from me? Have you seen the Wookiee lately? It always hurts. It always hurts when you kill a character. I remember the third Demon War book, The Demon Apostle. And I won't mention it because it'll be a spoiler to people in here, unfortunately. Someone very near and dear to me didn't make it out of the book. Hurts. Hurts a lot. Hurts more to write it than it does. Did you read The Ghost King? Who read The Ghost King? Traumatized. I was traumatized. Don't anyone say a word about that anymore. It hurts. It always hurts. But they never found Chewie's body.
It can happen.
I got emails.
All
right. I dropped a moon on a Wookiee. I dropped a freaking moon on it. I destroyed the whole planet under his feet while the Millennium Falcon's taking off away from him. And he's waving his fist and a moon fell on him. And within 3 days of that book coming out, my email filled up with, aha, they never found the body. No kidding.
Given how the Ghost King ends, since we can't say, would you return to the Catterly family in the newer books?
I don't know. I doubt it. But I don't know. You never know. The funny thing is, and Susan's going to know this when she reads the outline I sent her. Is I generally don't know what I'm doing in the book I'm writing. And that's the truth. I have a general idea of where I want a story to go, and then I have fun writing it. And all kinds of weird things happen that I never expected. And that's why writing the books is as fun for me as reading books are for most other people. It's just the way the thought process works with me. I have no idea. People die, and I go, holy crap.
I didn't see that.
Then they come back, and I go, oh, cool. You know? I mean, was Wolfgar really dead in Legacy? It took me 4 years to figure that out. Yeah.
How much work do you do to keep up with what other people are doing in that sandbox of the Forgotten Realms? Are you reading all the other novels as well? And
I say, Susan, help. Are you kidding? I am freaking old. And I have always been the guy. It takes me a month to read a book. I am a horrible reader. It takes me a month to read a book. I'm talking a Charlie Brown book. Okay? No, I am a horribly slow reader. I don't know why. It just is the truth. I What I do is whenever I'm getting to something that I know might touch on someone else, I spend most of my time hiding from everybody else, and we set the parameters pretty clearly on what they want out of the book beforehand. You know, where I can go, what I can blow up, what I can't blow up, that type of thing. And then, of course, they change it when the book comes out. Thousand Orcs. We want you to use Obuld Many Arrows from the campaign saying, oh, he's cool, I'll use him. But if I'm using him, he's going to die. And they say, oh, cool. Just rip his head off. Great. So I write Thousand Orcs. I send it in. He's still alive, but the whole story arc is him going down in flames. And then they go, well, you know, we made a mistake on the timeline. And the FRCS actually takes place after your books. So you can't kill Obuld. Thanks. But actually, I really like Obuld by the end of the series, so that worked out for the better, that one particular. But so basically, I rely very heavily on the editors at Wizards of the Coast just to make sure I'm not crossing lines, because I can't keep up with it. I'm old. When I DM first freaking edition. When I play fourth. When I DM, it's first. I'm old. Who hasn't asked the question? Go ahead. Okay, anyone hasn't asked the question wants to jump in? Go ahead.
So what you're saying is that any given time, if you're writing a Drizzt story, you could die.
I think I just said that. How do you know he hasn't? Gondelgrim's at the printer. I may surprise you all, and the only one who comes through the leap is somebody else.
You just said there was
you got six more books.
Six more books.
No. I say Drizzt books, but I consider the cleric books Drizzt. Drizzt to me is like Forgotten Realms books. Doesn't mean he's going to be in all of them. Servant of the Shards is Drizzt book.
I like Grimmel's
book. Road of the Patriarchs is Drizzt book. Spine of the World is a Drizzt book.
Is that the Promise of the Witch King?
So, you know, maybe we'll have an entire series about Tibbledorf.
I was thinking Rumbledore.
Or Aphrodite. Or Ivan and Pickle.
Ivan and Pickle.
Yeah. Yeah.
Last time you were in Chicago,
by
the way, why aren't you going to the Midwest Book Signing Tours anymore?
I have no...
I don't think Midwest, I understand.
I have no say on where I go on book tours. And that generally comes about. Book tours are pleasing book chains and book independent bookstores. That's what book tours are. So the people who yell the loudest get the book signers. It's that simple. When people write to me and say, will you please come to Podunk? I say, you have a good bookstore in Podunk? Tell them to start yelling and we'll probably go to Podunk. Because the last thing authors... tours are expensive. Yeah. Flying is expensive. Hotels are expensive. Media escorts are expensive. The last thing a publisher wants to do is spend a couple grand bringing somebody into a town and then have go to a book signing with three people there and they all work at the store. And that happens. So the stores that they think are going to get a big draw, and then the book chains like Barnes & Noble will say, we have a budget for it here, we want them here. Okay. You know? And then you've got stores like Mysterious Galaxy in San Diego, and Elliott Bay in Seattle, and Powell's in Portland, who are New York Times reporting stores. You see? And now this year we've got two stops in Canada, because Canada has been very good to me. Yeah. We do really well in Canada, and they've been asking for stops, and we go. And we went to Toronto last year and had a huge signing, and it was a blast. So that's how those go. But go ahead.
But in Chicago, you had some father, you know, I think it was the Road of the Patriarch tour. And you had some father, you know, asking, hey, is this book cool for my kid? And you said, hey, go get Servant of the Shard. This is really more of a mature themed book. How are you dealing with writing more?
I don't think I said Servant of the Shard.
Well, you recommended him Servant of the Shard. He was going to buy a robot. You know,
I don't think I would recommend that book, though.
Well,
that
you recommended one of the other
sure,
kid
I got
friendly
you.
Books.
Yeah.
And my question is, when you're writing on a more advanced, as you're writing on a more mature level, how do you tackle that? Because I know you wrote like one of the first Forgotten Realms sex scenes in *Road of the Patriarch*. So how do you advance like that as a writer?
A lot of what I do, honestly, is I just look at what's on TV, and if I'm under that bar, I figure I'm okay.
Okay.
And believe me, I'm way under that bar. I try to write my books. I've had people come up to me and say, your Dritz books, your audience has grown up. They have to grow up with the audience. I said, what do you mean? You want me to show boobies in the books? I don't consider that maturity, dude. But beyond that, I would rather get a letter from a 15-year-old kid who said, I'm having a hard time in high school. I'm in a bad place. I found your books, and these are my friends, and I love reading now because of your books. I would rather get that letter. I would rather get one of those letters than 25 letters from a 40-year-old guy saying, you've unraveled the mysteries of life for me. I really would. And I'm not saying I want people my age to be able to have fun reading the books. And I want you to be able to read them on several different levels. I think there's a lot of things in the Dritz books that are very analogous to the world and make statements about the world that at least make you ask yourself questions about the world. When I was younger, I thought my job as a writer was to give you the answers. I'm brilliant. Listen to me. And then I realized, I don't know shit, man. Okay? And I realized that what my job is as a writer is to get you to ask the questions and find your own damn answers. Okay? Dritz books do that. Okay? I don't need sex scenes in them, but sometimes I do. The one that was in there was really important for Artemis and Trier.
Oh, yeah.
It was critical. If you read Demon Wars, Pony's Wedding Night is critical to that series.
You're right.
I still pull the curtain down. Mm-hmm. I do not... One time, a friend of mine asked me to put a quote on this book. And he's been a friend for a long time. And I said, sure, of course. And he sent me a couple of chapters of the book because I didn't have time to read the whole book because it was going to press. It was a last-minute thing. So I read, I read slow. Like I said. Mm-hmm. I read a couple of chapters and said, this is some of your best stuff. And I gave him a quote for the book. And then I kept reading because I really liked it. I got to a chapter that was a 20-page description of oral sex, leaving nothing out of it. And I called him up and I said, take my freaking name off that book. Got in a huge fight with the publisher. I don't ever want a parent picking up one of my books, and I don't care what book it is, and giving it to their 10-year-old daughter or son to read, and having something in there that is wholly inappropriate for that child. And I know, as a parent myself, that there is no way you are going to be able to... If you have a voracious 10-year-old reader, you won't keep up with that kid. Because you can only read the Laurel Ingalls Wilder books so many times. And, Twilight, just read the damn thing. I don't want to even know. That's a trust that you build. And I think you can say pretty mature things without, drawing the shade. So that's how I do it. And I do it with all the books. Now, I would never recommend the original Demon Wars series to a younger reader first. But not because of the Pony's Wedding Night or anything like that. I just think that the questions the characters in Demon Wars are asking themselves probably wouldn't resonate with a 10-year-old. Okay? In the Dritz books, I try and put some of those questions in there, too. The questions of immediate danger, friendship, those types of questions, as opposed to the philosophy of how the world should be, which is more demon-wise. You see? You just try and write them at several different levels and just hope people are enjoying them. That's all you can do.
I have two questions, slightly different tangents. One of them, though, is a book question. Have you ever had, since we were talking about killing off characters, have you ever killed off a character, it's gone to print, and then they... And basically, I was wondering, like, Bruner, whether or not you were told, no, we want him to come back.
I can say at this point in time, and even back then, one of the beautiful things of working with TSR and Wizards, if I sent a book in to Susan and Dritz is dead, she probably would give me some pushback on it. And some of the people at Hasbro would probably give me some pushback on it. But with all confidence, they've trusted me with my characters all the way through. I have never had them say, oh, don't kill that, except for Obelwood. But that was different, because that wasn't my character. I would never think... They won't let me put Elminster in the book and say, no, I'll kill him. No, but seriously, I would never think to kill someone else's character, for example, unless they told me, oh, kill him.
Like you.
They made me do that.
Did you explain to Comic-Con?
He still getting black.
Are you going to write any more about Garlaxle?
Huh?
Garlaxle.
What about him? I was thinking, in fact, I was planning for Gothelgrim, the sixth book in my contract, my last contract, the fifth book in my last, the last book. I'm old, I don't remember how many. The last book in the contract, the one that's coming out this year, is the last book in my last contract. I was planning for that book to be a Jarl Axel, Zach Nafane story set way in the past, long before Dritz was a twinkle in Malice's eye, right? The realm's changed. Doesn't mean I won't do the book. It means this isn't the time for it. We have too many stories to tell to get the readers caught up with where the realms are. Okay? So it's not the right time for it. I may try and slip that in this six-book series. Okay? It may happen. But right now, we had other things we had to accomplish in the books. But yeah, I've thought about it a lot. That would be fun. Going back to Menzel Burns on back when House Bay and Ray owned the place and everybody else killed everybody else. I like that. You know what Menzel Burns on is based on, by the way? Mario Puzo's The Godfather.
Yeah.
When they told me to create The Drow in the Forgotten Realms, I pulled out that awesome book, and it is an awesome book. And, you know, I'm an Italian kid from New England. It works for me. I had never watched The Sopranos. And then a few years ago, I watched a couple of episodes, and I said, wow, this is pretty cool. This is like my neighborhood. I cannot tell you how many funerals I went to with a bunch of fat guys in dark suits standing around going, what are you going to do? That they got the dialect. They got the affect down perfectly in that series. I've watched it like five times now. Every like February, I said, okay, Sopranos, pull it out. Start at one and go all the way through the Don't Stop Believing. You betcha. And that's, you know, so Puzo was a natural fit for me. Yes?
To elaborate on her question, you elaborated to the fact that Jarl Axel was a very warm male child and that he lived.
Yes.
Now, granted that Lolf likes chaos, I understand that. Please tell me that you're going to explain that because I almost.
Thought I did.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah, where?
Well, I've hinted at it with Muriel
O'Dodra. I mean, explain.
Well, if I ever write the Jarl Axel Zach Nafane book, I'll lay it out for you in great detail. I think it had something to do with a psionic power. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I'll leave it at that. I have to leave it at that. I haven't figured it out. No, I'm only kidding. I'm only kidding. I know the story. Someday we will reveal the entire story of Jarl Axel, and then it'll be boring and no one will read them again.
When you're writing your books, do you, like, take anything from present day, like a crisis or something? Or,
yeah.
You know,
did you read The Pirate King? Power vacuum is a good thing. Yeah, of course. How can you not? How can you not? How can any writer not? You think I believe Tolkien for 1 minute when he says The Lord of the Rings wasn't based on World War I, World War II, and all of that?
Mm.
I don't believe him for a minute. He doesn't believe himself. Yeah, of course. Of course. You always look at what's going on around you. This is where you get your inspiration. I know more about any issue that's going on in this country right now. Any issue. If you want to argue with me about politics, he'll tell you. You better bring your wiki. Because I know everything that happened from primary sources. This is what I do. This is how I do my research. Because when you study things like that, what you're really studying is society and human nature. And that's what books are about.
Now, is there anything that you got halfway through the book and something happened and you thought, hold it here, I need to go back and change this or
sure.
Add on to it?
Sure. When I write a book, I'll start and I'll go about 80% of the book. And when I get at 80% of the book, I will go back and my mornings will be rewriting and my afternoons will be pushing forward. And you push forward a lot slower than you rewrite. So as I get to about 80% of the book, I now have a list of things. I may have gone into the chapters and said, add this here. because things have happened during the story that if you don't go back and preface them, what you wind up with is the dreaded Deus Ex Machina, right? You know that concept? Deus Ex Machina. Okay, there's a dragon attacking the town. You're watching this movie. The dragon's wiping out everybody in hell. There's no way to beat it. And the hero falls down, moves a rock, and there's a sword. And he picks up the sword and stabs the dragon and kills it because that's what that sword's purpose was. But nobody knew it. That's called Deus Ex Machina. It's a lousy literary device. And what it basically means is, you know, the hand of God is how you survive. And you've all read books like that where all of a sudden somebody all either becomes godlike or finds this super spell and then saves the world at the last minute. And it came out of nowhere and you go, wait a minute. So you go back and you rewrite while you're finishing the book to make sure you have none of that. Now, I did a twist on that because Jarl Axel is my walking Deus Ex Machina. The whole point of Jarl Axel is no matter what you put him in, he's got something in his Batman utility belt. Get him out of it. Jarl Axel is a walking Deus Ex. That's his purpose in the world. That's why I love the guy. And I remember when I was writing Servant of the Shard, some of you may have heard this one before. I was like so excited because Jarl Axel is going for the first time to become a major character in the book. Like a main protagonist in the book. And I was excited, and then I went, I'm totally screwed. I have no idea what he, what I've given him for equipment, what I've taken away from him for equipment, what other properties his equipment might have, and I'm looking at a pile of books this high that I have to read. Now, read slowly. Before I write this book, and I have 4 months to write the book, and I'm like, I'm dead. I can't use Jarl Axel. Wait a minute. So I went to a message board. Anonymously. And I said, hey guys, let's do an inventory of Jarl Axel's cool items. A couple days later, I downloaded a 10-page thread. You guys are great. They had page numbers. They even speculated on what some of the things might be able to do we haven't seen yet. And Jarl Axel was ready to go. Deus Ex, baby. Yes.
Stork.
Stork.
The Highwayman. What's your inspiration for him? Because I love him. He's an awesome
The Highwayman character. Is one of my favorite characters. He is an incredibly physically flawed human being and an emotionally scarred human being because of that. And it takes him several books to even realize he was emotionally scarred. We had a kid. Every town has... You see the people walking, and they can't really walk right. They've got cerebral palsy. They've got whatever. And you wonder, what's the world look like through the eyes of someone like that? And so here we've got this young kid, Stork, who is fighting this horrible poison that was put in his system by an act of mercy by his mother. Right? That's how Stork got hurt. In the womb. And through no fault of his own. And he's had this miserable life. And he is tormented constantly, except by one or two people. And what comes out of that is a person who has to go through this incredible journey in order to solve his own issues and come to the point where he thinks there is a greater good. There is community. There are sacrifices that are worth it, and not just for personal gain. I love the character.
That's why I love him.
I love the character. Absolutely. And that's where he came from. And, you know, that was a journey for me to write that book. And I've had people come up to me. I had a guy come up to me and handed me the Highwayman and he burst into tears because his son has a debilitating disease that he's going to be battling his whole life. I'm going to read him this book, he said. And it was just, you know, it doesn't get better than that as an author to be able to reach out and touch people. And at the same time, it's painful to hear it, you know. But, yeah, pretty cool character. Pretty cool character. That's why, one of the frustrations is that I know the numbers a Dritz book will get. And I know the Demon Wars books won't get anywhere near those numbers. Not even close. And it makes me crazy because I think that, you know, and it's not just me. This happens for every author. You wonder why Robert Jordan kept writing Wheel of Time and everyone was saying, boy, you know, it's time to end this. If he ended it, he's done, and he knows it. You know? Terry Brooks writes a Shannara book, and he sells. Mm-hmm. Then he writes a Magic Kingdom book, and he sells.
Yep.
I write a Dritz book. Mm-hmm. I write a Demon Wars book. And it's sad that it's the truth, but it's the truth. But I really wish, that's why when someone comes up and says, you never kill anybody, it's like, want to see me? Because I know they haven't read Demon Wars. Yeah. One guy, you should read George Martin. I have read George Martin. He's a great writer. Why wouldn't I read George Martin? Well, because, you know, you have to learn how to kill people. Have you read Demon Wars? No, shut up. I know how to kill people. I like it.
For Gontalgrim, I think it's pronounced
Gontalgrim.
Gontalgrim, yes. Creating new companions, was that a challenge for you? Do you ever put a companion in and then change it?
What new companions?
No new companions, there'll be no.
I wouldn't tell you. One of the exciting things about the 100-year jump for me is putting Dritz in new situations that. I will tell you the in Gontalgrim. Here's a don't spread this around, Dan. The first Dritz essay in Gontalgrim. Unless Susan messes it up.
No pressure.
It's Dritz. Actually it's the first Dritz essay in the next book. Okay, I can't talk about it. It's not in Gontalgrim. Never mind. I like that, huh? One of the things I'm doing with Dritz is going to have to come to terms with some emotions that he's not expecting. You know, you can feel really sad and then feel guilty because in a way you feel a little free. A responsibility has been taken from you. And it's pretty conflicted. And kind of a license to rage, if you will. And you'll see. That's all you'll see. I can't say anymore because I don't even remember what book I'm talking about. Yeah.
Two of your favorite, my favorite characters are Dar Axel and Artemis. What were your choices for those two characters?
Well, Artemis was a mirror image of Dritz. I mean, that was the whole point of Artemis, was so Dritz could look at him and say, that's who I would have become if I had stayed in Menzo Berenzon. Because Artemis isn't really immoral. He's amoral. And he's amoral because he just thinks the world sucks so bad, who cares? He's just one of those people who has, and if you read the backstories on him that I've written, just, he got broken by trauma. And so he doesn't care. And had Dritz stayed in Menzo Berenzon, I think he would have been like Zachnafane, and I think Zachnafane was a lot like Artemis. When you think about it, Zachnafane was slaughtering with impunity, right? Opening scene of Homeland. Thank you, Malice. They're all going to die now. Loves it, right? Zachnafane relished killing matron mothers and priestesses. That's not a good act, even if they're drow, because he's a drow too. That's not a good act. He just didn't care. I think Artemis was kind of the same way. So he was put in there as kind of a mirror to Drith's soul. Jarl Axel was because I wanted to play with Deus Ex Machina. I wanted to have my cameo appearances by this guy who could just get himself out of anything. You know? And, you know, I remember when I was writing Promise of the Witch King. There's a scene in Promise of the Witch King when Gareth Dragonsbane goes down to see Artemis. And Artemis says, you hate me because you are me. And you can't deal with that. And just because your pretty laws say it's okay for you to stomp people, you're still stomping people. So don't pretend that because you think you have the weight of the law on your side, you're doing anything better than I did, than I'm doing. And that really shakes Gareth Dragonsbane. And I thought it was the most important scene in the books. The whole point of the book was that scene. And then when they did the audiobook and they sent me the script for the audiobook, they took that scene out. And I called up and I said, Phil, you're kidding, right? And he was like, I know. And we put the scene back in. So I needed Artemis so that Artemis was a vehicle for Dritz to realize the road he was walking as to the road he was destined to walk. Yeah. And then he just got cooler.
With this 100-year jump, are you excited about the new opportunities for the views of society on groups and from 100 years past?
were going there anyway? Because Dritzen, if you look in the later books, I don't think he was like getting spat on when he walked in the gate anywhere. Because even the people that wanted to spit on him knew that if they did, he'd cut them to pieces. You know, I think it's a logical change for him. So it actually makes it easy for me to not have to keep revisiting that thing that I pretty much solved in the books. You know, and the fact that, because one of the things is, one of my favorite scenes, I think, of Servant of the Shard is when Jarl Axel impersonates Dritz.
Oh, yeah.
I am Dritz the Warden. Hope. And that's in there for a reason, because I think we lose sight of this. We live in a world where, you know when certain people who Twitter are going to the bathroom half a world away, right?
Well, yeah.
The idea that in a world like the Forgotten Realms, what happens in Kalimport would have any resonance in 10 towns is ridiculous. One of the things, until very recently in our world, people grew up, lived their entire lives, and died in the same town, having never visited another town. The reason why our government is structured the way it is, in terms of electing people, is because it took weeks for people to get back from their colony, back from their state to Washington, to say who won. Mm-hmm. That's why you had electors, right? So I always try to keep that in mind when I'm writing the books. But I don't want to have to revisit Dritz's first entrance into Luskan every time I go into a new city. Been there, done that. Several times. So now I don't have, that's just one less thing I have to stall and revisit something on for me. So I think it's a very logical and good change for me with Dritz. That he will be accepted. There are good drow, right? And I do take full responsibility for ruining the coolest monster ever put in D&D in the Dark Elves. I didn't mean to do it, but I did. Sorry. I get hate mail from DMs. All my players want to do is play a dual scimitar-wielding ranger drow. You suck. Actually, at Gen Con, true story, a few years ago, kid comes up and he looks at the books, he looks at me. He wrote those in. He goes, "Oh, a good drow ranger wielding two scimitars. How cliche." And I said, "Thank you." I don't think he got it. But. Anyway. Yeah.
Seeing your shirt actually did make me one of my little favorite things with regards to written stuff. Languages.
Yes.
How many, did you guys actually need any language creation?
We have a guy at 38 Studios named Brian Labor. He came from Ironmore. And he's one of these, he's a total geek. But he's actually a Renaissance man. I mean, he plays softball pretty well. He plays this pretty. He's an athlete. He's an animator by trade. He can design content, and he's got a thing for languages. And he actually came up with languages for every race in the game. I don't know how you're ever going to put it in the game, but it's we have fonts and they make sense and
Okay, so it's not just simply one or two.
No, we actually, he can write, this is Gnomish. This is Gnomish.
I like it.
It really is. It's bizarre, okay? Yeah, it's very cool. I had a kid write me a letter in Drow once. Remember the old Drow the Underdog?
Yep.
And Ed Green with it at the back did a glossary of words. That kid write me a letter in Drow, so I answered them in Klingon. Her. Always was a her.
Yeah.
When I wrote the Crystal Shard, it was a her. And they told me, no, you have to make the cat gender neutral. And so I did. And then a copy editor put in him in a couple of places. I swear that's the truth. Always, always Guinevere. Guinevere is the Celtic or Welsh spelling of Arthur's queen. Okay? It's a her. writing, well, she's around. I mean, as a main character, that'd be tough. The language barrier, you know? But I can do it for Pickle. I can do it for her. It's like writing the Tarzan book. I wrote the Tarzan book. Do you know that?
Yeah.
Yeah, way back in the day, they were going to do this, you know, when Hercules and Xena were big shows on TV, they were going to do Tarzan. And so they hired me to write the book, and I agreed because I was going to get to work with the grandkids of Edgar Rice Burroughs, who I never met, never spoke to once. They lied to me. And so they sent me the screenplay, and I wrote this Tarzan book, and I was like, but how do you spell that yell? Ah. yeah, it's really awful. Don't buy it. novelizations are painful exercises. So, she's around. I don't think she'll have her own book anytime soon. But actually, I know someone just told me they're naming their daughter one of our, which is kind of cool. But I always get scared when people write me letters they name their son Dritz. And I write back and say, I hope you taught him to fight.
Yeah.
By the way, I created it, and I can't pronounce it. Yeah.
So, if, going to the world of speculation for a moment, if you could take in any area or characters in the realms to and play with in your part of the sandbox, what would you do with it, and where would you go, and who would you go?
I would torture Elminster to death.
Is there a part of the world that you... That, fascinates you that you'd like to explore?
Well, in the old realms, the place I really wanted to expose Mithranor, which I thought was the coolest place ever. In the new realms, I'm waiting for all the fallout to happen. One place I wanted to explore was Luskan, which I did. Okay. Another place I really wanted to take to the new realms was Spirit Soaring, which I did. It seems like everything I'm touching is turning to crap. I'm burning places down. I'm blowing places up. I'm killing people in the process. It's kind of fun. It's free. I don't know. I would like someday to go back to Menzel Berenzahn, because I think Menzel Berenzahn has not been touched very deeply in terms of the overall place, and I think there's a lot of cool books there. And I like it when I go back to Ten Towns. It feels like I'm going home. Because I made that place up. So,
what about the other drow city besides Menzel Berenzahn?
Chednesa.
Is there much of a... I mean...
I don't know what they're doing with that. I know they toasted it pretty good. And
Well,
I don't know if they can say that.
Yeah, they toasted... They wanted Menzo, I wouldn't give it to him, so we killed Chednesad instead.
Thank you.
Good call.
Now, were those...
Then Rich Baker took a good shot at Menzo, and I had to pull him back a little bit. Like, knock it off, Rich.
Now, were those the only two major, like I said,
they're the only two I've seen detailed.
Okay.
There may be others. There are others mentioned.
Yeah, there's one under Skullport.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there was one.
There's one thing.
Yep. Yep.
There's one by
Kellenport. See? You're asking the wrong question. That's a good question. Yeah.
How hard or easy is it for you now to wipe the Dritz lights? Because sometimes I have to do it sometimes. Just a picture of it in my head.
Exactly.
I just watched the dancers on America's Got Talent. It's hard. It's actually harder now. Because you can only... describe whirling scimitars. So I'm out of adjectives, man. And you got to keep coming up with new twists in the terrain around them, or new monsters to fight and stuff. And it's hard. It's not an easy thing to do. Which is something that new characters might, with new fighting styles, might inject into the books. Yes.
Oh, the monkey. I forgot which book it was with. Artemis, was it Cain?
Yeah, Promise of the Witch King.
Promise of the Witch King. That was one of the coolest. I really liked that character a lot.
Not my character.
Really?
Yeah. I wrote a book for TSR many, many years ago called The Bloodstone Lands Resource. My wife actually wrote it with me. Where we took the modules that Doug Niles had done on Bloodstone. He did this great series of modules. And Gareth Dragonsbane, Cain, all of them. except for Montolio. No, not Montolio. Maribron was mine. That I added in the book. I added some in the book, but most of the characters, the named characters that you met in that book, were Doug's characters. And they were awesome. Every one of them. And I don't even think they were all Doug's. I think they were Doug and the players at his table when they were doing the modules. They created the characters, and they were awesome. And so, not mine. But I love the cleric quintet was supposed to be the monk quintet. But second edition came up. And so they said, there are no monks. They got rid of the monks and the assassins, right? And we don't want to feature a monk in a story. This was before they had the fighting clerics come back, right? We don't want to feature a monk in a story, and we got rid of the monks. I said, well, what do you want me to do? Because I was thinking of going to the Monastery of the Yellow Rose, right? From those modules. That's from the modules. And I said, well, we really want you to write a series about a cleric. He said, cleric? Right, this first, second edition. Because the cleric is the last guy who comes to the table and says, hey, can I play? What do you guys need? You're the cleric. Shut up, sit down, and heal me. Do you want me to make him a main character in the book? But it worked. And that was supposed to be set in the Bloodstone Lands. But then they made me get out of there, too, because Doug really was taking ownership of that place, and they wanted him to write books there.
So I just throw Danica in there, then. If the monks were gone.
I cheat. I told you, 70% of my job is to work around the game designers and the editors. And so I... Well, can I have a cleric as... Can I have a monk? I mean, it's still monks, right? Can I have one as a minor character? Yeah, no problem. Okay. I told you. I cheat. It's fun. But you know why Pickle is named Pickle?
Yes.
Do you all know why Pickle is named Pickle?
No.
Okay. When I wrote The Halfling's Gem, I was planning the fourth book to be the retaking of Mithril Hall. Right? Remember The Halfling's Gem? They go down to Kalimport, and then they come back, and they're going to retake Mithril, because they were at Mithril Hall. It's run by the Grey Dwarves have it. And then they had to chase Entreri and Regis across the world to rescue Regis. And then they're going to come back and retake Mithril Hall. So the fourth book was going to be the retaking of Mithril Hall. But TSR, my editor, said, you know, people are done with these characters. This is 1990.
Where are they now?
People are done with these characters, so wrap it up in the epilogue. Retake Mithril Hall in the epilogue. So we have a nice ending, and we'll go on to something else. We'll find something new to do. Okay. So I wrapped it up in the epilogue. But I needed, because of the timing of everything, without getting into this long, drawn-out thing, I needed a dwarf general to lead the charge to retake Mithril Hall. So I came up with what I still think is the best dwarf name ever. Thorin Oakenshield, step aside. Dag Nabbit.
Yeah. Yep.
So what happened, subsequent to that, this is right before I drove Eric into the church. Eric was catching a ton of heat from some really serious game designers who thought we were mocking dwarves, and they didn't like it. That's a silly name, and Eric was catching all kinds of heat for that. So Eric told me, because now this is a couple of years later, the book's been out and the feedback's been in, Eric was really mad at me because he didn't even notice the name. He was, you know, going through last minute things. And he was really mad at me, and he said, if we ever come back to this character, you're going to name him Dagna. We're getting rid of the Dagnabbit. Okay, my flag. So now I'm writing the cleric quintet. I got an idea for a couple dwarves. Boulder Shoulder, I know I'll get away with. Ivan's a good dwarf name. And I needed his brother. And so I, P-I-K-E-L. I mailed the manuscript in, and I waited by the phone. And the phone rings. Bob, it's Eric. Hey, you got the book? Pickle? Cucumber. I said, no, pickle. I said, are we talking the book or are we talking garden salad, Eric? He said, no, you have a dwarf named Pickle. A dwarf named Pickle. Ivan's brother. I said, no, it's Pykal, like the weapon. It's pronounced like the weapon. He just spelled it wrong because he can't spell. It's Pykal. Oh, all right, never mind. All right. He's got green hair. He braids it over his ear, so his head, he's a pickle. So after I drove Eric into the church, you will know this. Dag Nabbit is the son of Dagna.
I win.
The other good one when we had to change from second to third is Adam. I mean, from first to second edition is Adam Centuri. I'm working on Homeland because they said we want to go back. I get a call from Jeff Grubb. He's the coordinator of the realms, poor bastard. He's herding cats for a living. So Jeff calls me up and he says, Bob, how are you going to kill Entreri? I just wrote the Halfling's Gem. Now I'm working on Homeland. Entreri's not even born yet, right? I'm not killing Entreri. What are you, crazy? I'm just beginning to like the guy. Oh, no, you have to kill Entreri. But we like him, so we're going to let you do it. I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? He says, there are no assassins in second edition, and all the assassins are getting their souls sucked up by an evil god. But we don't think Entreri should die like that, so we're going to let you kill him. He said, Eric, I'm writing a book that takes place 80 years before he's born. We'll write a short story, son. We're going to let you kill. I said, I'm not killing Entreri. You have to kill Entreri, or we're going to kill Entreri. I'm not Eric, Jeff. I'm like, Jeff, I'm not killing Entreri. But back and forth, I don't understand why we have to kill Entreri. He goes, because there are no assassins in D&D anymore. He's not an assassin. He's a fighter thief who takes money to kill people. And Jeff says, we can do that. I win. I told you my job. You people weren't believing me. Yes.
This question does pertain to Artemis. It's the 100-year jump. You know, him being human, and you know, I know some things. About
you're new to the part of the answer. Yeah. Go ahead.
I know. But what's going to happen with him?
Anyone taping this?
Yes. I got it.
We'll play it back.
Yeah, it'll be on the internet.
I'm not going to tell you.
I'm hoping that means we'll see him again sometime.
I'm not going to tell you. And, you know, just you have to understand something. I'm going to tell you a story. When I was DMing, early on in my writing career, had a few books out. I had new people come to the table with me. Kid was my cousin, actually. He now works for 38 Studios, Ledger, Mike Ledger. And his friends joined my D&D group. So on one of their first adventures, they come into this barn, and there's a drow in the barn. They chase him up the loft, and what I'm describing, he's got two scimitars, he's got purple eyes. Back in the day, that was supposed to be unique, right? Uh-huh. And the eyes, I mean, right? That was unique. That was like the difference. That was just like this kind of symbolic difference of dress. So a couple of them were really into the books, and a couple of the others weren't. And they're trying to, we got to burn them out, burn down the loft, you know, we got to kill the drow. Wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. He climbs up the ladder, he says, you know, the drow's up there, you know, ready to go. And he says, Dritz? The drow says, what? He says, you're Dritz. He says, you've heard of me. Shh. Now they think it's a plot point. He goes downstairs, walks in the middle of the room, cuts them all down dead. And as he's leaving the barn, he says, what the hell is a dritz? So, don't believe your eyes.
With Pirate King, they introduced a whole new rose gallery. they kind of sort of slipped into a gray area as far as villains concerned. For you, what makes a villain tick?
What makes a villain tick? My favorite villains are the villains who don't believe they're doing the wrong thing. Or believe if they are doing the wrong thing, it's because everything sucks anyway. So you have Artemis Centreri, who thinks he never killed anyone who didn't deserve it. That's what he believes. You have Marcello Dionero from Demon Wars, who's probably the best villain I've ever written, who really believes that he's right. He really believes that he's right. And don't tell me that can't happen. Because I watched what I consider one of the most moral countries in the world justify torture. Don't freaking go there with me. Dionero did the same thing. Right?
Right.
So that's what makes a villain to me. Because somebody wakes up every day and says, I think I'll do evil today. It's boring. Okay? They're boring. You know, I mean, one of the beauties of fantasy is you have the embodiment of evil, right? You have an orc, and he's evil. And you kill him. You disembody him with your sword. You have a demon. You don't parlay with demons, you kill them. So I think I'll write Obul a little differently. Goes through a ceremony, he gets his wisdom increased, he gets all his stats, if you will, increased. He gets heightened, he gets empowered in this great ceremony by all the clerics. And they start saying, this is a better way than the way we've been doing it. And so now Dritz and Brunner are sitting there, and Brunner wants to fight the orcs. They can't win. If they go to war with the orcs, and the dwarves start the war, Silvery Moon's not going to back them up. Sundabar's not going to back them up. Nesmi's certainly not going to back them up. Maybe Adbar a little bit. But they're just not going to throw their men on the field when there's a truce being offered. And so Brunner wants to kill these orcs, but he can't. Because Mithril Hall doesn't stand a chance against the kingdom of many arrows. They might just be able to sit in their home and stay tight, but they won't even be able to get out unless they go under the river, right? And then you have Dritz, he's already vowed to kill this guy because this guy cut his friend in half. And because of this guy, an elf that he had come to care deeply about is gone. And Dritz is the one that has to say, what's best? And it's something that you will see if you read the beginning of later on, which book am I thinking of? The first book of Transitions.
Orc King.
The Orc King.
Yeah.
If you read did the 100-year jump, you will see that 100 years later, Dritz still isn't sure if they did the right thing or not. Right? That's what makes a good villain. A good villain is someone who has motivations that make sense to him or her. And don't just wake up every morning and say, I think I'll do evil.
Like the five captains of Musket. That was really cool. I like that.
It gets complicated.
You added a nice gray human element to not Durma. Who's the name of the wizard whose father was the captain and retired him?
Robolag.
No, not Robolag.
Oh, the wizard in town?
Yeah, the wizard in town who was the son of one of the five captains who stepped down and put him in charge.
God.
Yeah, I know.
There were 73 named characters in that.
Well,
Valindra was conflicted character. Arabeth was the daughter of the Marchion of Mirabar, right?
Yeah.
Arklum Greith ran the host there, right?
Exactly. And I like Arklum
Greith.
Who? Arklum Greith.
I don't know.
That's come
on. Yeah, I mean, that's the whole point, right?
Those are nice human spin on them, and they work very well. That Greith, when you took the Lich's point of view of, I lost, whatever, it's another 100 years.
Yeah. I'll outlast them.
Yeah.
How do you come up with your character names?
I close my eyes, I hit the keys, and I hope enough vowels pop up.
Because they tend to be really, I like your characters.
They're really hard.
I usually
name my characters Bob and Brian and Diane. And then at the end, when they finally tell me their names, I do a universal search and replace.
I can never figure out how to pronounce half of them.
I still don't know how to pronounce it. I don't care.
Can you pick one single book out of all of them that you need to
favorite? Mortalis. Book 4 of Demon Wars. Hands down, best book I've ever written, best book I'll ever write. My favorite Dritz book is still Homeland, although The Ghost King hit me in the gut in a really profound way. But Mortalis was a book I wrote. When I wrote Demon Wars, I figured there was going to be two trilogies. The story of the hero, and then the bigger story of the consequences of the actions of the hero. So, just kind of the progeny, if you will, of the hero, figuratively and literally. But then when I got to writing, finished the third book, and I started writing the fourth book, I realized I needed a bridge book. And at that time, my brother was withering away with cancer. And that book was my catharsis. And it was a way to express all my hopes and dreams and fears of life and death in a book. And when I finished the book, I sent it to my editor in New York, Veronica, and I said, this is either really good or really self-indulgent, and I don't know which. And she called me up a week later, and she said, we're not changing the word of this book. I still haven't read it. And the story gets even better, because that was the first book Keith Parkinson did a cover for me. I adore Keith Parkinson. I thought he was the most talented artist on the planet. or one up, certainly, right up there with any of them. And I've been wanting to work with Keith for a long time. And he did the cover of Mortalis. And on the cover of Mortalis is a character who completely took me by surprise, a guy named Brother Francis. And he's nearing his death. And if you look at that hollowed out picture of Brother Francis, it reminded me of the last weeks of my brother's life. So I couldn't, my wife bought me the painting for my birthday. And I couldn't hang it in my office for a while. I had to hang it somewhere else. I couldn't really look at it. And then, a couple of years later, Keith passed away from leukemia at the ripe old age of 45, same age as my brother when he died. And so I couldn't look at that for so long. But now I look at it, and I remember all the good things. And that book, I really think, is, yeah, it's my favorite book. That's my favorite book. Very important book for me. And I didn't mean to bum y'all out. my favorite chapter that I've ever written, though, is chapter 11 of In Sylvan Shadows, when Ivan and Pickle are trying to put a rock up a tree.
I like that one, too.
I was laughing like an idiot when I was writing that. I can't even imagine what people would think if I had, like, a webcam in my office. It's just bizarre. Who's got a question?
That you're reading now that you really
enjoy. I'm not. I read really slowly and it interferes. Authors I enjoy quite a bit. Many of my fellow Rome's authors, Paul, Elaine Cunningham, Ed Greenwood, Terry Brooks has been a favorite of mine for a long, long time. He's a dear friend of mine too. Walter Miller's Canticle for Leibowitz is probably my second favorite book behind The Hobbit. I think it's just absolutely brilliant. And then, you know, but, you know, with me, it's like, it's hard to say I like authors, because we're all a bunch of ass. No, I mean, because to me, you know, authors will sometimes write a book that just is their magnum opus, okay? Like Ursula Le Guin. Some of her books I adore, other books I can't read. Marion Zimmer Bradley, Mists of Avalon, is about as perfect an authorian book as you'll ever read. Yeah. Uh-huh. I can't read some of her other books. Nick O'Donohue was never actually got out of the Midlist. He was working with TSR 20 years ago, wrote a book called Under the Healing Sign. And I read it, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, I should quit. This is like one of the most wonderful books I've ever read. I felt enchanted reading this book. It's about vets that go to this other world and they have to treat like unicorns and stuff. And he's a vet. Brilliant. Brilliant stuff. And then I talked to him and he had sold like 14,000 copies total. And it was just, you know, there's no justice. I read a book a few years ago. They wanted me to quote this guy's first book. And the book was called The Waterborne by Gregory Keyes. And so I read The Waterborne and I thought, it had all the mistakes everybody's first book has, including mine. Every first book will have these mistakes, you know. But, boy, he's got something about his voice, and someday this punk is going to write a book, and I'm going to hate him. A few years later, he wrote a book called The Briar King.
Oh. Holy cow. What a book. Amazing book.
Another writer who knocks me off my feet, but I would never let my grandson read him, is Matt Stover. Matt is, a lot of authors say they're gritty. Matt is just downright nasty. He wrote the third Star Wars novelization, the last one. He wrote the last one. Terry Brooks wrote the first one, Phantom Menace. I wrote Attack of the Clones. Matt wrote the last one. And that is by far the best novelization I've ever read in my life. Brilliant writing. So there are lots. And it depends when you're in the mood. Like, I remember when someone gave me, said, you got to read China Medieval. So I took a Perdido Street Station with me to Aruba. Big mistake. You can't read Perdido Street Station on a beach in Aruba. It's 95 degrees. The water's 90 degrees. The sun is shining. The birds are singing. The rum is flowing. And you're reading Perdido Street Station. So, no. Put it away. Read it on a lousy winter night when the roof's leaking, you know? So to me, it's like, a lot of times when I hear people criticize books, what I'll say to them is, you weren't in the right place to read that book, emotionally. The only person who can determine the relationship between a reader and the book is the reader of the book. I remember when I was reading Dragonlance for the first time.
I got my first rejection letter when I was reading the first Dragonlance book. And I threw it across the room. I said, I can read better than this. I hated it. A few years later, I got published. I went to Gen Con. And they sat me behind Margaret and Tracy. And they said, you want to see how authors talk to their fans? Watch these two. These two are awesome. These two are, they're just right there. They love this stuff. And I watched one after another, people coming up and falling down over Kitiara or Tannis, right? Just in love with these characters. And I'm like, huh? And I went back and reread it, and I went, how did I miss this? This stuff is awesome. I wasn't in the right place when I read it. Don't tell Margaret Tracy I said that. No, you can tell him I hate it. Don't tell him I like it. Tracy's, no. He's killed me. He killed me after I left Killer Breakfast today. But, you know, and I went back and reread Dragonlance, and I understood why all these people were falling down over the character. The characters were brilliant. And so, you know, I'm not reading much, I admit, these days. I just, it interferes too much. I have a grandson now. Woo! I'm having fun. Yeah.
Now, after the fourth book in the series,
yep.
Is that, I mean, are you going to do any more in this series?
Nope, that's it. The series ends with the bear on August 18th.
Okay, so it's not, so more or less.
If I go back to Demon Wars, it will probably be with Luthien and Oliver.
So,
if I can unwrap the legalities of this.
So, these characters, they'll either, you know, are you killing them off, or just, are they just going to be in a
You think I'm going to answer that 2 weeks before the book comes out, really?
Come on, you can't blame me for trying. Yeah.
I get a call from two of our books. Bob, it's Tom Doherty. Thanks. It's like a couple of years ago, Publishers Weekly put up a review of the book. Publishers Weekly, they're supposed to know better. They gave away the whole damn book. And I was like, you got, and it's posted on Barnes & Noble and Amazon before the book comes out. It was like when I wrote Passage to Dawn. I gave people the manuscript of Passage to Dawn, and they, for most of the book, didn't know if it was going to be Zach Nafane or Wolfgar that came back in that book. And then the book comes out, and they put a freaking picture of Wolfgar on the cover. Thanks. And most of them were a hologram, remember?
Yeah.
So you go, wow, that's cool. Look, it's Wolfgar. And then you read the book, go, gee, I wonder if it's Zach Nafane or Wolfgar. Thanks. Nobody knows what's going to happen. I'm not afraid of it. I'm embracing it, and I'm getting on the front end of it. I was talking to one publisher that was proposing a pretty radical idea that I wasn't ready for in terms of payment. And they said, well, you know, if ebooks become 95% of our business, then you're going to wish that we had this deal in place. And I said, if ebooks become 95% of your business, why do I need you?
That's true.
And so you have a business model that is changing dramatically, and you have a whole bunch of publishers and authors scrambling, trying to figure out, how are we going to do this? Like, for example, one thing I keep pushing Wizards for. Tell me if this is a great idea. Take the Dritz essays and do them in 25-cent or 50-cent downloads on an iPhone.
Yeah.
Exactly. Or the short stories, not the novels. Novels, people aren't going to read a novel on their iPhone. You can have them on the iPhone, but novels are going to go to the iPad or the Kindle or the Nook, right? So, I mean, it is becoming a reality, and we're all, I think, just trying to figure out how's this going to work. Because you got to understand something. Authors get paid a percentage of the MSRP, right? So if I write a hardcover and it's $30, right? Not me, but any of the authors. It's $30. We're probably making like $4-4.5 on a book, right? If the ebooks come out and that goes down to $8 because everyone demands that the books are cheaper, how are you going to pay the author? And the only way the author is going to be able to make what they were making per unit is to cut out the publisher. And that's not going to be good for anybody. Because if you cut out the publishers and the publishers hurt, what's going to happen? You're going to have certain authors that you keep going to, and then good luck finding new authors, because there's going to be 9 million of them. With nobody doing the pre-reading for you and trying to help steer you. Now, publishers, one of the publishers' jobs is to take this gigantic hopper, right, of manuscripts and whittle it down to what they think the reading public will want, either because of mechanics or cliches or problems with the books. If you take that hopper off the business, good luck finding what you want. It's not like music, right? You can find the song you like in 30 seconds. You can't find a book that you like. Sometimes it takes several chapters before you really get into the flow of what's going on in the book. So it's scary for a lot of people. I mean, I'm not scared by it because I'm an established author. But the people trying to break out today, for you people who are writers, you know, you get a book out there. Do you self-publish? Never self-published. That's what I was told when I was coming up. Really? Chris Paolini self-published. And then it was picked up by Knopf. He's doing all right. It's all changing. I'm not afraid of change because I think it'll sort out correctly. Authors understand the value of editors. Every author needs a good editor. Authors understand the value of publishers. The question is going to be, you know, you get Google alerts on your name when you're involved in the marketing, like I'm with 38 Studios now. One of the things we're supposed to do is do the Google alerts on your name just to see if people, what the buzz is on the trailer or whatever for the game. So I'm doing Google alerts on my name. Half the Google alerts I get on my name are, buy this book here. And it's pirated. The R.A. Salvatore audio collection. Really? And then I got a letter from a kid saying, man, I bought this book in audio, but they did a crappy job. I could, like, hear cars in the background. Somebody got their little MP3 in the book and read the book and then sold it for $100 online. And when you talk to these people who are doing that to you, when you confront them with an email, you know what the answer is? Artists should want to share their work. This is why I'm killing people. Yes, we do, but there's an entire structure here that if it's not there, the whole thing goes away. Now, in music, the microtransactions worked. Because you can buy a song for 99 cents, right?
Yeah.
And so what happened? People started spending 10 times the money on music than they were spending when they had to go buy a CD.
Because you could get the one song you wanted.
Right? Everybody won, right?
Mm-hmm.
And all the one-hit wonders, they were all of a sudden doing great again, right? Can't do that with books. How many books are you going to buy in your lifetime? Many people say lots. People who read like I do, will I read 20 more books in my lifetime? Probably not. I'm not going to put 500 books on my Kindle. I'm not going to get to that. Well, you read fast. I don't. So it's scary, but, you know, it's happening. There's nothing you're going to do. You can't change it back. I don't know that I would want to. I mean, I was sad when Barnes & Noble and Borders drove the independent booksellers out of business. I was ripping mad when Walmart was selling the Harry Potter book at such a discounted rate. They were taking a loss on every book, and the book chains actually lost money on Harry Potter. Walmart doesn't care if you're paying $9 for a $27 book and they're taking a hit on it, because you go into Walmart, you can leave a $300 worth of junk anyway. Right? You go to the bookstore to buy the Harry Potter book, what do you leave with? The Harry Potter book that they just had to put an extra shift on for the midnight sale when it came out, right? It's short-sighted sometimes. I'm taking the long view. E-books are going to work. We just have to figure out how to make them work for everybody involved, particularly the reader. Because you don't give the readers what they want, it's not going to really matter what cut the publisher gets and what cut the author gets, right? So.
Even right now, though, buying e-books is not much cheaper than going and buying it.
There's a lot of pressure.
And there's less paper.
There's a lot of pressure. And I mean, think about the bookstores. They have to charge tax, and the internet doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, even that. Yeah.
When it comes to characters, you always don't get your hands on, and I'm sure you've explained in the past, why did it come into this one character so much?
Because he hates it.
No, I love Ed. That's why. Because I'm in awe of Ed. Ed created the Forgotten Realms when he was 8 years old. Are you kidding me? I found out last year I'm older than Ed. That's the other thing. He's younger than me. And he still looks the same as when I met him in 1989. No, that's because in the realms, everybody always says, Ed and I get, we both get the letters. Who would win the fight between Dritz and Elminster? And I write back, who's writing it? Because if I'm writing it, I guarantee it. And when I was the guest of honor for the RPGA, when they used to do the RPGA breakfast at Gen Con back in the early 90s, I went over to Roy Van Tilburg's Off-World Designs booth. He makes t-shirts. He paints t-shirts before your eyes. Brilliant. And I had him make a t-shirt for me. So I went up and I'm doing my speech at the RPGA breakfast, and I held up a t-shirt, and on the front it's got Dritz from the cover of the Larry Elmore cover of The Crystal Shard, where he's kneeling in the snow, and he's got his fingers up in his blood, and he says, methinks the old mage went too far. On the back of the shirt, you see Elminster, and he's like this. His hat is on the ground, and it's crumbled, and you see this big shadow around him, and coming down is a disembodied Monty Python foot. Wearing an ankle bracelet that says AO. Ed still has that shirt. Ask him about it. So when I say I'm going to kill Elmas, that is nothing but good-natured, you know, me and Ed fighting. Ed is my hero, and he lets me play in his world. I love the man to death. But not the way Ed has in mind.
Yeah, we said something about the... Yes, the other day.
We were signing the other day. I mean, someone had to stand between us.
So you've been to a spinny arm day.
He saw me when I came in on Wednesday and kissed me on the lips.
That's what I said.
I start my HIV treatments tomorrow.
I was
going to
ask, since you do 140 characters on Twitter, why Elminster was dying?
If I ever tweet, which is doubtful, my first tweet will be a line from The Sopranos. When Tony Soprano goes to see Dr. Melfi and he said, life is just distraction until you die. And that fits Twitter.
All right. All
right, a couple minutes left. Well, okay, you haven't asked a question. Go ahead.
Maybe you already asked this already. But I was wondering what first
engagement... Entrary, I'm not telling you. Oh, no, go ahead.
This is about something you've already read.
Yep.
What first really entranced you with the character Dritz when you first wrote him up? And after 25 years, do you still feel that same kind of fire you have with the character?
Yes, absolutely. If I wasn't loving him, I wouldn't be writing him. Dritz wasn't in... 5 minutes? Okay. Dritz was not in the proposal for the Crystal Shard. And they sent me the stuff. They wanted me to write the second Forgotten Realms book. The only thing they had printed was Doug Niles' Dark Walker on Moonshae. In the original Dark Walker on Moonshae, all you had was a map of the Moonshae Isles. They're tiny. Doug's characters owned the place. So I figured I had to use one of Doug's characters, Derek of Kalimport, and Cantus the Moorhound, to introduce the hero of my book, Wulfgar. Sent in the outline, got the book. I had sent in the proposal, the audition, got the book. But then they said, no, we don't want you to set it here. We want you to put it in the realms. And I'm looking at the map, and I said, we want it in the water? And they said, no. We didn't send you the map. So they sent me Ed's original maps. Stack of 8.5 by 11s, not numbered. Some with just lines on them in a mountain. Finally, we sorted out Icewind Dale. This little typo at the top of the map when they printed the map. I said, because it was like, can I go here? No, you can't go there. That's Cormyr. And Ed's going to Cormyr. Well, how about here? Well, that's Bloodstone Lens. We'll even have to Doug. Well, how about here? No, that's so-and-so's writing a series here. How about here? And this went on for 2 weeks. In a world this big, trying to find... All I needed was, 100 square miles of land. I said, what about that little thing above the mountains? Anyone got that? That typo? He said, no. I said, that's Icewind Dale. Leave me alone. I made Icewind Dale. But then I got a call from Mary Kirchhoff, who's the editor, and she says... Bob, we got a problem. I have to sell your book to the marketing team so they can, the sales force. But I don't want you using Dareth. So I'm not using Dareth. I never wanted to use him. He was just to introduce Wulfgar. I said, but the sample chapter you wrote was Wulfgar and Dareth.
And I have to go sell it in to the marketing team. I said, all right, I'll call you back next week. I'll come up with a new sidekick. And she says, no, no, you don't understand. I have to go to a marketing meeting, and I need a sidekick for Wolfgar. I said, okay, well, we got lunch coming up. I was a financial analyst. So we got lunch coming up. I'll work over lunch for you, and I'll call you this afternoon. She says, you don't understand. I'm late for a marketing meeting. So I thought about it for a minute, and I said, a blackout. They used to call them blackouts back then. Long pause. She says, a drought? I said, yeah, a drought ranger, that'll be cool. No one's ever done that. Long pause. I said, Bob, there's probably a reason. I said, no, it'll be cool. I'll do a drought ranger. No one's done that. We'll have a drought ranger. She says, all right, since this is a sidekick character, I'm going to let you get away with that. What's his name? And I went, Dritz the Warden of Demon the Show's been on the Ninth House of Menzel Berenzahn. She said, what? I said, I don't know. She said, can you spell that? I said, not a chance. There it was. So I started writing the book. And I was writing a scene with Dritz running across the tundra room. The Yetis jump him and Bruna comes out. And I knew on page 2, same Wolfgar's book, it's his book. And I spent the next 10 books beating the ever-loving snot out of Wolfgar. He took over. I knew as soon as I started writing him, this is his book.
Well, that's the latest Gen Con special episode with R.A. Salvatore Seminar. I want to thank our sponsor, Noble Knight, and Bart Carroll from the official D&D podcast. I'll get you, sir. I'll get you. If you want to get a hold of me, please give me a call at 919-BIZ-TOME. That's BIZTOME. Give me your comments or questions about Dark Sun, or share your Gen Con story to be included in more of these episodes. I may also be talking to some of the people who worked on the Psionic Power book, so if you have questions for them, send them along. Do it at 919-BIZ-TOME. That's 919-BIZ-TOME. And of course, you can always email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com or visit the forums at vorpalnetwork.com. And please consider doing a review of the show on iTunes or tell people about it. It helps get the word out, helps more people find the show, and helps us grow. And don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store for products discussed in the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and then it helps keep us on the air. And I did just spend a good part of the day yesterday adding more things to the store. But don't forget, if there's something there that you want, just say the word and I'll either add it or send you a link so that you can get it in a way that gives the show credit. Links for things mentioned in the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. And this has been a Gen Con special with R.A. Salvatore Seminar from
The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome.
I'm on the wall.